set up here. Clock on. Okay. I did a three word challenge. I did a three word challenge and I was going to read that, and then Cedric just blew it, you know, it was just too good to follow. I feel my three line poem wouldn't be worthy of following it up. I just should say, it's a terrible day to get a 2 day on a Sunday. And so I had to get an emergency filling this morning. But my dentist is quite a chatter. And we managed to have a quite detailed conversation about Wolf Hall while I was getting my teeth done. I think she might need to maybe slack off in that aspect of her practice. Anyway, I'm going to say I had a good friend who studied here in Crawford College of Art and Design, and when he was here, I used to come down to Cork quite frequently, and I haven't been down in some time. But just coming down from the B&B today, it did strike me it'd be a very hard city to do your driving test. There's a lot of hills in this place. I did mine in Seattle, which is bad enough. I'm going to start with the first poem in my second collection. You've already gathered that there'll be a slightly scientific flavour to some of the work tonight. And in a way, this poem, I'll start at the beginning, almost quite literally. This poem is called Footprints on Lava, and I recently the glasses have been mirrored with an opening. So this is called Footprints on Lava. There is little we know of them, except they were upright. Their footsteps leaving a trail across cooling lava for 40 paces. Imprinted, hardened, covered over, lost beneath millennia of sediment. The climate shifted, this soil so gathered washed away again in increments. The trace finally exposed and discovered, carbon dated to a time before memory. They moved towards us from the nowhere of our beginnings to some place dimly stored within us. Woman, child, man, walking. Footprints on lava. That was an extraordinary discovery by Richard and Mary Leakey in the 1970s, and the work they did in Tanzania and that part of Africa about human origins is really singular and extraordinary. As was mentioned, I edited in as the millennium was turning, it seemed like a good time to put forward ideas for an anthology, and I came up with this brainstorm to get 10 Irish poets to each pick a decade and pick 10 not necessarily the best poems of that decade, but the poems that best registered the currents in Irish poetry. So it goes through the whole century, 10 poems a piece. And you know, it was an important anthology and it was pulled together quite quickly, and it was proofread to within a comma of its life. And I was a typesetter, so I felt an extra responsibility in that regard. And when the book came back from the printer, resplendent, I opened it to see an extraordinarily bad typo. And I thought, has this happened? And I had to broach it with the section editor. And he said, look, it's cool. You know, I was quite surprised to give me that. And he said, every first edition should have a typo. And that's how they are, in fact, identified. So that gave me this poem called Book Collector. But I should verify this because there is this thing called the internet, but I didn't bother going on today. But apparently, at least in the literary canon, the book with the most typos in the first edition is Ulysses, with about 1,700. But you could appreciate the typesetters union going, look, mate, you know, it's not even in French to begin with, and it's not even in English, really. But I'm surprised Finnegan's Wake didn't have more. But maybe we had a tougher crew in there.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the fact that we'd won. But the one was From Waiting from Godot. I think people just saw the word Godot and waiting and missed the rest. So this is called The Book Collector. This is the longest poem I'll read tonight. I was going to read my 300-line epic, Timepieces, but I decided not to. The last time I read this, I forgot to read the last section. So if I don't read the section called Books, do remind me. And I also always forget, because I should have really put an end note on this, I mentioned the lungs, tennis court, the flesh. And this I picked up from reading James Gleick's book, here's the sound coming in, about chaos theory. And the lungs are an extraordinary thing in that the way the flesh is folded, there is actually covers the surface area of a tennis court. It's very hard to oxygenate blood, which people discovered when they started doing the first transplants. So that's what that reference means. People think I'm kind of referencing tennis. So anyway, this is called the Book Lector. It's the only poem I've ever written in couplets. One, first edition. Strange that I authenticate a work, not by the brilliance of its content, but by the error of the printer's hand, as a letter is lost or jumbled in the groaning print works. The flaw, the mistake, the error of judgment and oversight, the misdetailed and botched sentence that runs into the page gutter like a thought that was never finished. The missing apostrophe and comma. All the things that went astray in the process of passing the thing from one hand to another. Two, in the Library of Lost Objects. The words settle on the page for the first time, like insects fixed on their pins in a dusty museum. Never before seen in the world, a new thing. An order of words captured and reinstated from the day's flux and insistence. A sleight of hand trick that holds the world back for a heartbeat. Holds. Holds. And then they're passed out into the city, scattered to the corners like ragged confetti, stacked in market stalls beside postcards and love letters, lined like foot soldiers in toppling bookcases. The unwanted gift or capricious purchase, discarded, misplaced, boxed up, forgotten, used to keep the wind from the chimney, shelved absently in the library of lost objects, waiting for us to find them. Three. Inscription. And this one does somehow, dog-eared from use, weathered, ossified, organic, surviving the memory lost in detritus, the grinding entropy and metamorphosis. Nothing much to look at, water damaged, it finds its way to me in this haphazard thrift shop, among the tattered paperbacks and half-priced cookery manuals, the remainder astrologies with their outdated prognostications, the promises of love that never happened. My dearest James, in these pages we can be together. Let us meet here in the white spaces between one word's ending and another's beginning. Love, Kate, December 1907. Four, books. The weight of books, their bulk and physical space, how they pull downward in the hand like a plumb line sighted to the ground. The shape and texture of thought, folded and folded again, like the lungs, tennis court of flesh. Mine's fingerprint and afterimage, all that we'll remember by when we're finished. I'm going to read a new poem. So I better speak to the microphone since it's been recorded. I'm going to start with some new poems. In the last year and a half, I've been working on a new collection, and all the poems are the three sections, it's books in three sections, and they're all sequence-based. So in one way, it's a little bit difficult to pick and pull poems from that. But this sequence is ten dramatic monologues, five from the perspective of men and five from women. And it would have been tempting in an Altman-esque way to connect these narratives. But you will notice, as I read through them over the course of the next few minutes, that there's a reference to rain and all. So the summer rain of the title is the connecting tissue, nothing else. And in a way, that opens it up in a way that I think is more interesting than connecting them. Sorry, just rehydrating, as they say. So this one's called Christine, and it is actually a deliberate move by me to move away from science with these sections, these poems, but this one has actually scientific context. Christine. I place a drop of blood. Sorry, I'll start again. In poems. Christine. I place a drop upon the slide, then spread the blood along its length, the bead smears to a pinkish layer. Not every day is bad. Most bloods are as they should be, the white and red cells as portioned, as populous as the next, made luminous and still by my microscope light. I study what I see with an expert eye, count the cells in the feathered edge, and confirm the worst. Progress of a dare in the lens, spreading inexorably from one cell to the next. this woman I've never known beyond her altered chromosome. Soon she will be laid to waste for what I spy in this cyclops eye. She, not knowing yet her fate, as she sits in a cafe somewhere perhaps, the rain drumming against the window glass, a dulling, restless metronome. She smiling as she picks up her cup, telling her friend it will most probably be fine. I have tried to be as dispassionate as the lenses stare. This blood work I do too far from the living world to feel real, protecting me from my own fear. But if I look too closely there, I might see my own daughter's hair, my mother's smile, my husband's stare, the blue eyes of the one I love. Today I try, but cannot escape the mortal flaw that I reveal. I turn off the machine to a humming click, the black light lingering a moment, then sinking to black. Like the sky, my small office window frames, and the weight of the news I must give tomorrow. This next poem is about quantum mechanics. So I wrote this poem. I feel when I write about science that I don't want to add footnotes. I feel the poem has to carry its own meaning. And I feel the same is true of myth, and I'll read a poem about myth after this. But when I wrote this poem, I immediately came up with a title, and then I realised someone else had beat me to that title. And had won the Booker Prize for a so-named novel, God of Small Things. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll try God of Smaller Things. By sheer coincidence, I came across a Norwegian poet called Niels Christian Rohm Mokstad. What a great name that is. And he'd written a poem called God of Smaller Things. So it's God of Small Things. I really told you that story to distract you from the quantum mechanics. But anyway, hopefully it won't confound you. It's called God of Small Things. It was late. I was in my room above Botany Bay, the cherry blossoms below hidden in darkness, the windows two black rectangles against the night. I faced the page of quantum mechanics, the equations spilling down the sheet in ordered progressions of uncommon logic. I was trying to understand some intractable movement from one line to another and stared at the page, puzzled. Quite suddenly I grasped it, the elegant equations coming into clarity, then dissolving in front of me. It was as if I had glimpsed for a moment beyond the numbers and symbols to the luminous totality of the reality beneath. The intricate structure at the base of everything opening like a door into a passageway that I didn't know existed. I came back to my senses and the room, dazed and changed. The cherry blossoms still swayed below, there yet concealed in darkness, hiding their daylight brilliance, like the world I had just encountered, fleeting but actual, and everything I had known to be certain, questioned. Time for heartbreak. This is a poem called The Rings. First section. Nothing like heartbreak in a warm climate. The English patient once had an Oscar for it. But, this is called The Rings. Excuse me. The Rings. Washing my face, my eye catches the silver of the ring on my left hand. My surprise every time. My face stares back at me from the mirror, your naked body pale in the shadows as you bend to recover your dress from the floor. I turn. There are such moments when we could almost believe. Such moments. How last night in the hotel lobby, the power failed again, and we gathered around the gaslight with the others. Mohammed playing drums and telling jokes I'd already heard in Dublin. The Americans with their stories of the desert. How you said so little, while I, tempted at every turn, elaborated on the details of our life together. You, silent and unhappy in the shadows. How one smile would have been enough. That day in Dublin before we left, the rain bucketed down on us. We walked out among the city streets oblivious in a trance of expectation. Then stopping in a stall on College Green, bought two matching silver rings, cover for our travelling together in Islamic North Africa, our faked marriage, an imaginary honeymoon in better weather. We laughed at the silliness of it, but pressed the rings deep into our pockets and thought of nothing else all evening. Today, I find your ring on the dresser. Last night before you went to sleep, I noticed how, tired of unnecessary fictions, you placed it there, and I knew that you would never wear it. Bit of myth. Again, a bit like the science stuff, I think previous generations of Irish poets and the other poets have drawn heavily on myth, and I just don't think we can assume the shared knowledge anymore. This is really kind of placed in a contemporary setting. It's called Cadmus. But Cadmus, just to say, was the Phoenician prince who said to have come up with the alphabet, which the Greeks adapted into the Greek alphabet. So that's all you need to know, really. So it's called Cadmus. He looks adrift standing there beneath the glass and concrete of the arts-blocked building, dressed in sloppy collegiate tweed, his hair grey and unkempt. His fingers grip a plastic spoon as he works the tea bag hard against the side of the cup, mumbling to himself in some forgotten tongue, the chanting rise and fall of the line, a fragment perhaps from Homeric Greek. Odysseus becalmed on a windless night, counting the stars in the shifting light. Tea made, the old man turns and pushes past, a sharp-tongued student holding court on Derrida and a deconstruction of art. Then stuffing his papers under his arm, he shuffles into the sudden crowd, Cadmus lost in the kingdom of the mad, invoking the symbols of his forgotten world. Ah, yes. I was asked to contribute a poem to an anthology called Constellations. And if you ever got an email from a woman called Rebecca Jane Irvine, I recommend you reply to it. She's a wonderful character and the funniest person I've ever met by email. And anyway, there's a list of constellations. And I kind of thought, I don't want to do the myth thing. I haven't just done the myth thing. I don't want to do the myth thing. So I just picked this constellation by its name. And there's a truly fascinating story behind it, which I might say a little bit more afterwards, but I just wanted to say that the constellation I chose is called Telescopium, and this poem is set in the 1760s. Telescopium. The sky had been all but named, beyond some small studded corners in the darkness above them. There at the Cape of Good Hope, Abbé Nicolas de la Caille built his observatory after a long voyage. This the very vantage point he needed, as he set out to map the southern skies into its 10,000 points of fire. And hidden there between Corona Australis and Sagittarius, he taught to give this humble cluster of stars its own name, not in honour of some ancient god or fabled creature, but the eye of the telescope that peers deepest into the firmament's recesses. This instrument so named in light, the object of his calculating vision, and the one true God he sought in every corner of the heavens. La Caille was an extraordinary man. He was given 2 years to undergo this task, and it took him 9 months to plot sky map 10,000 stars. And on his way home, he decided to do an ordnance survey of the Canary Islands. And then when he returned to France, he gave them change. And they said, no, really, Abbey. He was a deacon of Roman Catholic Church. He was about to be ordained a Jesuit and seemed to have gone through some crisis and took on this task. And it's extraordinary. He said, no, I didn't spend it. I never got no, please. And honestly, he deserved it. And he wouldn't take it. It's a remarkable story, but he died at 48 by, perhaps in the 18th century, what they would call overwork. Not surprisingly. But Rebecca has approached me again for a new anthology about the elements, and I've taken on Einsteinium. No idea what that's going to be about. But we'll see when I get there. This is another from the monologues. And I should say the title of the new book, Summer Rain, is really, there's one section that I can't read from. It's a kind of verse drama about the late 19th century Austrian physicist called Ludwig Boltzmann. I'd have to be a very, very skilled voice actor to do it. So, but that's called Entropy. He was the man who defined what we understand entropy to be. But the recurring theme of the book, I suppose, is entropy and renewal. So this poem is called Stephen. For 4 weeks, I have sat in this room in silence, studying the deep burgundy of the walls, the blank grey screen and the television. I noticed there was a spider in the bathroom, perfectly still in the web of its own making. With each visit, I checked to see if he had moved. He hadn't. I assumed he was dead. I returned to my chair and looked at nothing. In this way, we passed our days together, neither of us stirring from our vigil. In July, the spider was gone. From him, I learned the nature of patience. I get up finally and go outside into the garden, stand by the cherry blossom and inhale its musk, rain falling about us both. Another cycle in the book is a kind of 21st century reworking of pantheism. And I've been accused of not writing nature poetry, but I guess when I do it, it doesn't count like nature poetry people expect. So this is it's called Into the Recesses, and it comes from a quote from Wordsworth, which reads, "A lake carries you into recesses of feeling otherwise impenetrable." And I'll read a couple of poems from this. And again, these kind of work as a cycle more than anything, and it's about the cycle of water. But this first one is called Triple Pint. The three boundary lines converge in the phase diagram to an exact point, describing water in its three states. This, the meeting place, a precise measure of temperature and pressure hovering just above zero. The mist that rises up from the lake's surface, a lingering vapour, the crystalline flower of ice that glistens, the soft, cold touch of liquid, all coexisting by some natural magic in the near freeze of the autumnal evening, the water shape-shifting from one form to another in a delicate balance, it being all things at once, as sometimes the laws of nature will permit. Thank you. Yeah, it's hard to make science exciting, isn't it? That is true, though. At 0.073 degrees, water actually coexists in the three states. Which, as I said, there's a pantheistic team. If you're at a higher altitude, the temperature shifts, but at ground level. In fact, it was the way they determined ground level in the 19th century. But, I could be wrong, but I think that's true. It's about water, but it's also about the life in and around water. And this poem is called Otter at Rydal. And I suppose it is probably the most explicit nature poem I've ever read. She moves quickly from the hole towards the river, the snow plotting her footsteps over frozen ground and foliage. She slinks into the water, mammal but river tide, sliding outward into the tensing current and drawn slowly downstream by the river's muscle. She ducks beneath the water before surfacing again, inspects the bank with a fleeting glance, her fur greased to a skull cap as she looks about a moment and goes under again. Her two dark eyes now two dark windows onto the watery gloom below as she smoothly descends into her second world. I'm going to finish with about three or four short poems here. I'm also working on another sequence. Excuse me, alcohol is really not a good way to soften your mouth's dryness. I'm working on, sometimes when you're writing something, other poems come up. And as I say, I'm on a bit of a sequence thing. And this is a sequence I've been working on kind of since putting the new collection in a drawer to let it cool off. And it's called, it's a sequence of poems, relationship poems called Streetlight Amber. And this, the backbone of the sequence are prose poems. And then there's three straightforward poems. And there's an English poet called David Harsent, who's a wonderful poet, if you ever get to read him. And he said a poem should always hear music. And I'm inclined to agree, although I don't think music has to be full rhyme or alliteration. But I even think the prose poem has to have music. And in some way, by getting rid of the line break and the sounds of break, you get rid of, in one way a tool, but another way a distraction. So there's an emotional straightforwardness to this material that I didn't want to interrupt with that kind of technical achievement. So this is called Sky Maps. Awake to a sense of forgetfulness.
Thank you.
I'll start again. I should also apologise because so much of this stuff is new. I haven't read it before, so it's not quite in the brain circuitry yet. Sky maps. I wake to a sense of forgetfulness, casually reaching to your side of the bed to remember it empty. I long for the world I thought existed, the promise of us. I go back to a moment before I met you. I walked across a field and looked up. I saw the sky above me, and I was ecstatic to be living, to stare up and have my heart blown open to the colour of the midday blue, there in the lazy heat of the summer afternoon. This I learned from you also, though bodily, at your hands, and you at mine. How love's gifts and judgments are beyond our knowledge and will outlive our longing. I get up finally and go to the basin, watch my face clean to the cold comfort of water, towel my jaw dry and hold my stare. This the daybreak hour.
Thank you.
Nice that I knew of them all. This poem is called Reykjavik, and I will end on this. Apologies for the misstep there. As some of you will know, I'm sure, the Greeks had two notions of knowledge, really. And they were logos and mythos. And that's pretty self-evident that logos is logic and mythos is myth. And it's interesting in today's world that we highly lionize logos, but apply it to myth and then call it, you know, a falsity. So you don't have to talk about old myths to create a new one. And in this poem, I've tried to create a self-created myth. And it's a poem called Reykjavik. And I'll finish on this. And the renewal that was promised in the last poem shall be fulfilled in this. So this is called Reykjavik. And I will have someone at work that kind of gave me. So, I'll end with this, and thanks for your patience, and I hope you enjoyed it. And it's been great to be here in Cork. It's the first time I've ever read in Cork City, and it's a wonderful event.
Whoa.
Yeah. Even John Gielgud lost his lines once, I heard. So, you know, it can happen. Hopefully I'll be invited back. So this is called Reykjavik, and I'll end on this. Thank you. At first it was the word I heard, simply the word. The throat tightened, the tongue taut, to spit out the sharp V, the clipped K's. The rumble of the oar in the cave of the mouth echoes a harsh landscape. Ray, Ki, Ya, Vic. Then there was a grey canvas that lay empty for days, just hanging there somewhere inside the mind, swaying to the trum of that syncopated word. It a mumbled mantra of sorts. Today it is a grey sea, grey sky rising from it, flexing a heavy swell and fall, coughing up a white froth. From below, the seal god comes, calling from his underworld. Swim deep, cross the sea, how else will you learn to speak? Blue is my world now that I follow him. We weave a slow course beneath the fishing boats, soundlessly dodging the nets they drag behind him. He has brought me to the waiting room of myself across the blue corridor of ocean. But I must not be fooled, for soon I will stand alone on the glacial shore. The waves lash against the rocks. I crawl up from the surf, scramble over shells and stones and the thunder of seagulls that fills the world. The salty light burns my eyes. Colours are washed and metallic here. The sharp wind licks my skin. It is a messenger of the snow. Follow, follow. The city squats not far from here. I suppose it is a city like all others. People busy in the shops and streets. Cars going past in a steady flow. Conversation shuttled along the counters of restaurants and pubs. It is the currency of the living blood. I do not seek such comforts this morning. It is the violence of Genesis I'm after. The waters breaking, the red mess of afterbirth. The first sounds garbled out into the weak daybreak. I begin to walk. With each step, the years dissolve. I strip back self, layer by layer, till there is little left. The scrawling in a bird's nest, the mysterious writings on the underside of a stone, the windswept syllable of the moon. The word forms again on my lips, Reykjavik. The place is named. I return to where I began. A window, a desk, a piece of paper and pen. The night huddles against the pane. I, all alone, in my hidden den. Thank you very much.